Okay, good morning, everybody. We start our October board meeting, and we begin our discussions with a discussion on goodwill and impairment. And I give the floor to Raghava, who's going to unpick all the problems here.
Good morning, everybody. And now all these papers have easily digestible appetizers for you, so there's no heavy stuff in these papers for you, sir. And now the objective of this meeting is to conclude discussing individually the various possible approaches that might help in achieving the objectives set by you in relation to the impairment testing when adding this project to the research agenda. Now, this discussion should enable us to set out the interaction between the various approaches and ask you to make decisions about your preferred approaches at a future meeting, along with the question of amortization of goodwill. Now, agenda paper 18 sets out our plan of next steps, and agenda paper 18A explains the background and objectives of the research project. So I would first like to ask you for questions or comments on agenda paper 18 and 18A before we get into the detailed agenda papers 18B, C, and D.
Any questions? No. Oh, yes, Mary.
I'll start with a comment, which is just as a reminder of where we are today. I think it would be helpful as we think about this project to remember that it isn't a fundamental what should we do in this area, but it's trying to respond to the feedback that we had in, you know, from the PIR. And it's, to me, really, are there targeted fixes that we can make that either simplify without reducing the effectiveness or increase the effectiveness without introducing, you know, additional complexity and cost? And, you know, that, and then I think third, are there disclosures which would help in the mix that may not be here? I have a bit of concern that this is suffering a bit of scope creep in terms of adding things on that we're trying to fix. And so I just, when the staff brings back the papers, I mean, I think it's helpful to talk through the different things and make sure we've identified pros and cons of each approach, but to remember to put it in that context rather than saying, how could we solve all the issues that are being raised? Because otherwise, I think we'll find ourselves with a fundamental, let's reconsider it, you know, IAS 36 and our entire non-financial asset impairment model.
Anne?
I agree with what Mary's saying, because there's even references into the paper, into those bigger things, which is actually reconsidering the whole approach that's been used in IFRS 3 and IAS 36. So as we step it out, we're seeking to do and respond to the PIR, and we're seeking ways to do that. And if that's what we focus on, if they fail, well, then we may have it to make decisions about going back and reconsidering fundamentals. But I would like us to see on focusing in on the things that will address what's been raised and documented very well in the PIR process and try and get action that will address that before going into the bigger, unlocking bigger questions. Thank you.
Jung-woo.
Thank you. On this scope of this project, could you explain again that there is a couple of the paragraphs on the paper 18A, 2, 3, 4, there are objectives of this research project and scope. There seems to me, you know, different board members have different views on the scope of and objective of this research project. Even though this is started from the PIR over IFRS 3, however, I remember the board asked the staff to further explore the fundamental issues of A, B, and C. So basically focusing on goodwill and impairment rather than the others. So could you explain more clearly the scope and the objective of this research project?
I mean, I think the objective is, as Mary and Anne said, is to follow up on the PIR. It's not initially to go back and do a fundamental review. So I think paragraph two really explains the scope the board set following the PIR, and those are the topics we're reviewing in this.
Sure.
Maybe I can sort of follow on from that, and I think it builds on the points raised by the others. I think one of the challenges we have at the moment is we've been talking about this for so long, I certainly have almost forgotten what the feedback was we got from the PIR, and I wonder whether through the sort of comments that we gather today, whether it will be possible and whether it would be a good sort of objective for the staff that when they bring us the package of sort of suggestions of the way forward that might be included in the document that goes out for consultation, would be to try and pull back to what we think the problems are that we need to address and what our sort of objectives are going to be. Because I think if the package that you brought to us started off by saying very clearly, okay, given all of the discussions and where we've got, it would seem that the problems that we need to and slash can maybe practically address are A or B or combination of, and therefore that will give us a context within which to move forward. Because I feel like we're trying to, and I feel a real tension between the objectives of trying to improve the timeliness of impairment recognition while simultaneously looking at the sort of practicalities of applying the impairment test in particular. Mm-hmm. And maybe, and I don't know whether this is the right answer, but maybe if we reach the conclusion that we're really only making very small potential improvements to the timeliness of the recognition, and if we were to believe that the market understands that that is, you know, a challenge of the impairment model, that the market sort of tends to preempt whatever comes through the accounting, but there's still a good message for the market in terms of, okay, management now also thinks there's a problem here, so it's got confirmation value, which is valuable, but the exact timing of that doesn't matter so much. Maybe our prioritisation should be more on the simplifications aspects of it, plus some disclosures to assist investors with a little bit less of the emphasis on the timeliness aspect of it, for example. So I think maybe if, when we get the set of papers, we can sort of pull together, OK, given all of this analysis, where do we think realistically we can land in terms of what the problem is that we're going to solve? And we can, if we do a DP in particular, still talk about the sort of all of the alleys we went down along the way to reach that decision, but at least it would help, I think, us focus in our decision making, but also for the world to react to something a little bit more concrete than what we put out there.
Nick?
To my mind, just to clarify, I think issues A, B and C were all raised in the post-implementation review and have been very clearly in scope through this. I think Sue's suggestion of going back to that feedback is absolutely right. I mean, I reached for that this morning just to remind myself, you know, the strength of feelings from various constituents and stakeholders in this area.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I think I want to do a little bit of context here, just because I think a lot of people, I think quite rightly, are reluctant to go beyond the post-implementation review. But I think it's worth just reviewing what the staff have proposed with respect to it being an improvement. And so I want to just do a little bit of context and just to make sure that if we go that route that we do it, you know, fully informed. So it was funny, I did a lot of background reading when I got put on this group, and I think one of the problems of the background is there were so many different ideas out there and the terminology is different and the way people approached it was different. And so if you actually follow the history, there's a whole pile of complexity and complication to getting to where the staff got to. And I think it wasn't until I sort of took all that baggage and set it aside and then looked at what precisely the staff proposed that I started to understand what is being proposed. So I think my first thing is, I think there's a perception that we're doing what they're proposing is something that's really complex and costly. I don't believe that's the case, but if you follow the history and all that, I think you would carry the complexity and the history into your perception of what they're proposing. So I think that's kind of important. I think actually what they're proposing is relatively simple, and it was interesting, Mary said, to increase effectiveness without higher cost. Mm. You can actually do that. Now, you're going to produce something, what the staff's suggesting is going to be radically different, but it's not going to be higher cost, at least in terms of the cost of producing it. Now, there may be some secondary costs. So I think that's also kind of worth noting. And I'll sort of say why that I believe that to be the case.
So this is the next discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, I was going to wait till the next discussion, but since everybody came in and basically said that we ought to take out the next discussion as a viable thing, I thought this was a good time to say that.
So we need to be clear what our objectives are.
We didn't do
okay,
that.
Well, okay, I may have heard something different. So if you want me to hold, that's fine. But it sounded to me like there was a lot of sort of sense that this was probably not something to look at. And I can just pick it up later then.
All right.
If you like.
Yan Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I think actually impairment is a very difficult one, especially with regard to the impairment of the goodwill, but it's relevant to measurement. So I think when we go to move forward this project, we should be very aware that the objective of the measurement or the impairment, that is, I think, whether the approach we are going to adopt or even the simplification or other ways, whether we will, you know, provide useful information for users, whether it really will faithfully represent the real economic phenomena. I think these two principles should be bear in mind. And then we go to the two objectives. One is simplification objective, and the other one is effective objective. I agree, two objectives there. In some way, we can do something on simplification. But if we do this, we should not to decrease the information quality currently we have. Otherwise, maybe many users will disagree with our proposal. So we need to do this kind of analysis when we go to simplify our approaches. And secondly, we'll try to develop some way to improve the effectiveness of the impairment approach. That's to address the too little, too late issue. But when we develop this kind of the new approaches, such as headroom approach, it seems to me that it's contradictory to the simplification, because it will add some cost and complexity. So we should have some balance whether what kind of way we should go and how deep we should go. If the preparer think that it will add a significant cost or complexity for them to do, and sometimes it's too subjective. So maybe as Sue just mentioned, maybe we should go simplification and some, I think, improve the disclosure. Yeah, with regard to the impairment method. So, yeah, this is I would like to address. But first of all, the principle, the objective of the measurement, we should bear in mind when we're developing the new approach for the impairment.
Okay.
So moving on now to the main agenda papers 18, B, C, and D. Now we've mainly structured these three papers in the following manner. So the main body of the agenda paper contains the analysis of either the possible approaches that you've briefly considered in the past but not discussed, let's say in the past 1 year, or possible approaches that the staff have considered for the first time in the research project, or the approaches that we've said in the past few meetings that we will bring back more analysis. So the main body contains basically analysis of these possible approaches. And the approaches that the board has already discussed in detail in the past have been included in the appendix. But I mean, for the benefit of all the new board members, we would still be happy to take comments on those approaches which have been set out in the appendix. But the focus would be on the approaches in the analyzed in the main body of these agenda papers. So first, moving to agenda paper 18B, which includes analysis of possible effectiveness measures to improve the effectiveness of impairment testing to make sure that impairment losses are recognized in a more timely manner and in the appropriate amount. So we've set out analysis of three approaches. The first one being a single method for determining the recoverable amount, and I think with the analysis where we are getting to is that if there are not many significant differences between value in use and fair value, would the entity specific nature of value in use give opportunity for management to manipulate the calculations to pass the impairment test? So whether the board decides to go down one approach or not, as we've set out in paragraph 35, that's still a question which the board could ask in the discussion paper. Now, the second approach that we've analyzed in this paper is a variant of the pre-acquisition headroom approach that you've already discussed in the past. So the analysis of the pre-acquisition headroom approach is set out in the appendix of that paper. Now, in the main body, as I said, we've included a variant which we've called as the updated headroom approach, which basically uses the headroom in a CGO at the previous impairment testing date for the purpose of impairment testing. Now, all that the updated headroom approach is doing is just to slightly change the existing the impairment testing model in IAS 36. Now, under the current model in IAS 36, impairment losses are first absorbed by any negative movements in the recoverable amount are first absorbed by this unrecognized headroom, and only then, once that unrecognized headroom is all vanished, then you would have the impairment of recognized goodwill coming in. But this model changes that and first allocates negative movements in the recoverable amount to acquired goodwill. So we think this approach would certainly bring forward recognition of impairment losses more closer to probably when there are events that result in impairment of goodwill. Now, the example that we've calculated in paragraph 60, in terms of the headroom that we've used, there are certainly ways of improving the arithmetic mechanism of that headroom, but we are not really getting into that discussion now because what we want is to understand whether the updated headroom approach does improve the effectiveness of the impairment test.
Mary?
I think it's three points on this paper. First, Raghava, you said in your TF, what we can explore in the DP. I just want to be cautious about assuming that we're doing a discussion paper rather than standing back after we have the discussion at the next meeting or the next couple of meetings, assessing the significance of the changes that we're proposing and then considering whether, what the appropriate form of consultation is. Because I'm not convinced that if what we're trying to do are targeted amendments to respond to the feedback in the PIR, that automatically has to become a discussion paper. The second point is on the one method is the sole basis. A general comment and a specific comment on this point. The general comment is that I kind of feel like the analysis in this section is maybe not stepping back far enough. And what I mean by that is we're going through the mechanics of concern about the subjectivity of value and use. Would life just be simpler? In theory, should they be that different? Blah, blah, blah. I think there are some good practice application points, reminders that VIU, at least as it is in IS 36, is not a pure management unanchored to observable data calculation. It's definitely constrained. So I think there's some points about education, awareness raising, about the application of the standard as it's written now. That's one point. But the not stepping back far enough concern that I have is the ISC, when it developed IS 36, looked at the time at the standard that the U.S. had issued, within the past 5 years, which was 121, and said, U.S. 120, FAS 121 said, let's look for a trigger for impairment, and once you trip the trigger, you have a notional disposal and reacquisition, and it's assumed to be at the then current fair value, so it's a reset as if the asset had just been acquired at that point in time to fair value at the impairment point. And the ISC said, no, we're building our model on a fundamentally different concept, which is write off to the extent something is not recoverable and with the exception of goodwill, if the circumstances change, reverse, because what you're just supposed to be doing is adjusting the carrying value for the non-recoverable bid. So when you look at the one method, I think the only method, if we were to go one method, the only method we could be looking at is value in use. That's not because I love value in use and I hate fair value less cost to, you know, to dispose, but if we're doing something that's targeted, I don't think we could go to one method being fair value less cost of disposal without it being a fundamental change in the concept and objective of IS 36. And I don't think we could make that change only for goodwill, because goodwill is assessed as part of a CGU, and the other items in the CGU generally are tested using 36. Now, you raise a concern in paragraph 34 that if the sole basis were VIU, then the unit of account would move away from the individual asset. I think I have some skepticism that reality is individual non-financial asset, you know, are being assessed for impairment outside of a CGU. So I think that while that may be a difference in concept in terms of driving you away from an individual asset, it's not a difference in practice, because I don't think I think in most instances a factory building is not being assessed separately. So that's comments on the one class.
Mary, can I ask you a follow-up comment? So if I recollect correctly, in your first set of comments you were concerned about scope creep.
Yeah.
But then you just made a comment about you didn't think you could look at this in isolation of looking at 36 more generally.
Oh, so how do I reconcile this? Just, I think what I'm saying is the section analyzing one model is just kind of weighing fair value less value in use without stepping back and remembering what the core concept of IS 36 is. And so I think the analysis of if we were to try and simplify to respond to these comments by saying just one method, I don't think we can just look at how hard and management, judgment, et cetera, is VIU versus fair value, without recognizing that if we were to go to fair value only, that it would be kind of inserting metric measurement equipment into an imperial measurement building, and something is going, plane, and something is going to crash because the bits don't fit. So I'm saying
it restricts our choices here because it's in the context of 36
overall, right,
as opposed to you're recommending we look at it more broadly.
Exactly. I'm just saying I don't think that fair value as the only method fits within existing 36. So that's one. The last one, and headroom. Well, Raghava, I'm very sympathetic to your idea that why should acquired goodwill be the last thing that's written off instead of the first thing, and that's what headroom is trying to get to. As I work through all of this, just my feedback on your assessment is it feels an awful lot like a calculated number rather than a recognizable measurement objective that portrays something for the CGU, and I have some skepticism about the analysis of how much more complexity would it introduce. But I think whichever way, you guys are going to bring a recommendation back to us on what the package should include or exclude. I think whichever way we go, we should be asking a question about it, whether we decided to pursue it because of X, or if we decide not to pursue it, to say we looked at this and decided not to because of whatever concerns. So I think it's helpful to have the analysis, but I am skeptical about your analysis about it not being much more complexity.
So maybe a couple of things, and I won't repeat, I don't think, what Mary said. I have some concerns with the idea of going down a single model. I think if I have a look at particularly paragraph 22, where we identify one of the reasons why we would want to go down a single model, seems to be because we've assessed, based on comments that we've heard, that the value in use typically uses over-optimistic cash flows. Now, to me, that's a compliance issue. And I suspect that if you force those same people into doing a fair value measurement, they may well start with those same over-optimistic cash flows when they do that determination. So I'm not terribly sure we're addressing the problem that's being spoken about there. I think the value in use model provides a significant simplification for entities because they're using information they have without having to consider whether a third party would look at this differently. I also would imagine that in most circumstances I can get my head around fair value is going to produce a higher value than value in use. Because as you've mentioned in your paper under IFRS 13, we would consider that the purchaser has the same ability to access resources that the company has. So they're able to generate the same cash flows, but potentially they may be able to generate better cash flows. So it seems to me they come to a higher view. So I would start saying I think value in use is a good measure. We may need to address if we think they're compliance issues, but I think they play into both spaces. On the headroom approach, I'm probably taking a slightly different view to Mary, and I just perhaps want to start with a clarifying question. If I think about this approach that you've recommended in the paper, what this essentially means is instead of having to compare my headroom of my present position to my headroom as it existed at the date of acquisition, I only have to compare it to the last reporting date.
Yep.
Now that seems to me as a starting point an operational simplification because I don't have to track data from forever. So not only does it seem to produce better outcomes, but it also requires less tracking of information. And then to Mary's point about whether this take now requires an operational complexity or a whole new... I would have thought that the way that you go about this is in the first instance to calculate the goodwill for the unit and then compare that to the carrying value of the goodwill. So you've got both numbers that you need. What we're now requiring you to is have those numbers from the end of your last reporting period and compare that to where you've got to now. The tracking as you change CGUs, I think, is also part of what we already require as a standard. So it simply seems to be that I have to have an opening balance that I compare my closing balance to. So I would go a little bit further and say, although we're addressing this at the first instance under better reporting, I think this also is simplified in the context of what we previously talked around in the headroom approach. And then I don't like the numbers in the table, but you mentioned that.
Yeah.
But the previous headroom approach was sold to us as which was fixed.
Yeah.
As more simple than updated one, and now the updated one is more simple.
No, I think the updated headroom there was updating the pre-acquisition headroom, not the headroom at the previous impairment testing date. So it was almost like, do we have to recalculate the headroom which was there before the acquisition at a current date? So there was that complexity in PH approach. And there was also further complexity about having to change that PH or starting to allocate PH when there's a new acquisition or when there's a restructuring or when there's a disposal. So I think this approach would certainly take out all those complexities that were there in PH approach.
Tuck.
Thank you. I agree with Daryl. And I think this updated headroom approach could be very simple approach, and I'm very much interested in this approach. So I just want to understand more. Let me compare with the IFRAG model and the amortization model with this updated headroom approach. Both IFRAG model and the amortization model has a standing on the same concept, which is the acquired goodwill would be replaced by new internally generated goodwill. Even if the recoverable amount stays same, then basically acquired goodwill is keep diminishing. So if we could measure the depreciation amount of acquired goodwill directly, it is best. But because it's not possible, what both models are doing is they try to recognize it by using assumption. So in the case of amortization, they use amortization period. In the case of IFRAG's model, they use accretion rate. But both are using assumption to measure the depreciation amount of acquired goodwill. So let's call it that amount, X amount. And what our model, new model, is trying to do is we give up measuring X amount directly because it's not measurable. But instead, you are going to measure simply the difference between the last year's headroom and this year's headroom, which is very simple. And then let's look at what's the ingredients of the differences. The ingredients of differences is the net amount with the newly acquired internally generated goodwill minus X amount. I mean, it can be replaced in 1 year, or it can be replaced over 100 years. However, all we can know is X amount, there exists X amount. The goodwill is decreasing. But instead, we acquire newly generated, internally generated goodwill. So if the new goodwill is larger than the depreciation of X amount, then we don't have to recognize impairment. But if the newly generated goodwill is smaller than the X amount, we just recognize this, the differences. So I think we do not directly address the measuring the X amount. However, we try to measure it by using the amount, which is quite obvious amount. So I really appreciate this approach. So, but only the shortcoming of this approach would be it depends on the accuracy of recoverable amount. So if the recoverable amount is subjective, then the credibility of entire model may be impaired. However, I agree with Daro. Daro said it's a matter of compliance. So if we have a rigid compliance, then we can assume that the recoverable amount can be measured reliably.
Well, it will always be subjective.
Yeah, always subjective.
But, yeah. Sue?
This is one of the rare topics where I don't actually have a terribly strong opinion on it. So I'm going to just make a sort of more...
Entering in danger as well.
But I guess having sort of suffered firsthand the initial market reaction to the pre-acquisition headroom at one of our conferences, that's very fresh in my mind still because it was such a volatile interaction. I think that one of the challenges we've got with this project is that the sort of expectation of preparers is we're going to make their lives easier. So I think even if we think that it's not that difficult to do, the mere idea of introducing an additional step into the process is going to be so contrary to what their expectation is that our response would be to the post-implementation review, that we're going to have to be able to demonstrate very clearly that there's a very real benefit in terms of the usefulness of information provided to the market to introduce any additional step, even if we think it's, you know, not too bad, because it's still something extra they have to do that they wouldn't have had to do before. So intellectually, I quite like the idea of what you've got here, particularly the updated one, and I think the points that Tack and Daryl have made about this operationality are interesting and helpful. But I think we need to, if we propose anything along these lines, I think we're going to have to try and find a way to assess whether we actually think that there's going to be a real benefit in terms of timeliness and information content to justify any addition of an extra step. And I guess building on what Tack said, one of my concerns would be that, you know, if you look at the table we've got here, and I know it has to be simple because we're just demonstrating the mechanics, but underlying this is sort of an almost like a notion that you can be very specific with these measurements from a goodwill perspective. And I think given the amount of judgment and the uncertainty around these recoverable amounts, would we really get a benefit in timing? Because my sort of gut feel, and I've never had to do this as a preparer, but my gut feel would be that it's going to be when something really drastic has happened that we're going to start picking up these impairment amounts. And so are we really going to get a big difference in outcomes, even if we put this extra step in, to justify having the extra step? And I think we need to find a way to analyse that a bit.
Can I just pick up on one small point then? And I think this did come in some of the discussion we've had around disclosures around headroom. The one thing that this model, the way we've just discussed, does do from a signaling perspective
is the instant at which the trend in goodwill goes from growing to shrinking. It reflects as an impairment. Yeah. So it doesn't wait until, as the old model did, until you get to the point where you now have eaten out all your internal goodwill.
Yeah.
So it has a significant signalling from that perspective.
I think we're going to have to be able to explain very well why we think that's a big benefit relative to the cost. I think partly I've got my sort of marketing hat on. If we're going to go out with this, we're going to have to be very clear what the benefits are for the costs that are imposed, because I don't think it's what's expected.
Gary?
Thank you. And a number of comments here. Let me start with one method versus two. Actually, I think we should keep the two methods. Don't have a hard and fast view of it. I think it doesn't add, as long as it's clear which one you use and how you apply it, it actually doesn't add complexity. Because you pick one value and use, you pick fair value. As long as they're clear, in itself doesn't add complexity. Now, if we had to pick one, I guess I'd go with value and use, because I think it's more entity specific, and I still think of it as largely fair value as well. Separately and later, I will get to the quantitative approach in one of the later papers, which I also support. So I'll say that now in case we don't get to that today. But I would go with the two methods on improvements and agree with some of the earlier comments that it's largely compliance about aggressiveness or lack thereof in terms of projections. I think you know my views on performance pre-acquisition headroom. I may never get there, but to have a detente with it, but also acknowledging what's going to come, feedback, should we put that out in the for comment? I think we need to deal with a couple things. First of all, the examples, by the way, I thought the papers were very well written, they were clear and got the points across. But the static example of one acquisition in one cash generating unit is inadequate. I think large companies buy companies all the time. And running a case with a dozen acquisitions over 3 years at irregular closing dates, the question is, what do you do about, if you do five acquisitions a year, do you have five updates to the pre-existing headroom, or what simplifications are you going to propose? At the same time, businesses move between cash generating units or operating segments, and you have discontinued operations. I think you kind of run an entire business cycle of how companies operate. How would you do it? The one example, if that was truly the representative of the world, probably would work, but it's not the way the world works. I'm more with Mary, is I think this is much more complex to do than the staff thinks it is, as someone who actually did it. But I think ASAF was negative on complexity, GPF was negative on it for complexity as well, and I think they'll be commenting on it back, and to some extent they're closer to it than the people in this room are. So I think, their input needs to be considered. I think we also need to answer the question, since if you have a deficiency in the calculations, it automatically assumes it's the acquisition goodwill. Well, what if you can demonstrate the deficiency was caused by something else? Do you allow them to have that? So take an example. You have, I don't know if it's a good example, but it'll illustrate the point. If you're in the fair value less cost of disposal model, and you've got securities at amortized cost, their market value dropped. You never intend to realize that lower market value, but if you can demonstrate that that's the reason why you had a shortfall, should you be allowed to look to, somebody other than the answer, automatically you impair some of the goodwill? And I think philosophically we're going to have to deal with, if you think the headroom is essentially internally generated goodwill, we don't put internally generated goodwill on the balance sheet because it's not reliable, measurable, whatever, but it's good enough to cause a debit. I don't think we can have it both ways. And I think those need to be addressed ideally before we even pick to go, if we go this route. In any event, it's coming, it's going to come back at us, even if we address it. So we should be prepared.
Nick?
Thank you, Hans. I think it's important to step back here and think about what problem we're trying to solve. and again the expectations of both preparers and users here. So what really matters to users, and it's very clear from the feedback that we got on the PIR, is the economics of the transaction. It's the cash return on cash invested. It's not the allocation of those that consideration across various assets. It's that day one cash number. The other message is very clear from the post-implementation review. It's about complexity for users and costs, not for users, for preparers, rather, and then judgments involved. There are some concerns about timeliness from users, but they're not made very forcefully. And largely when I speak to users, they're indifferent to this area. Mm-hmm. They don't believe that the test will ever get ahead of the market, will ever be there before the market gets there. So perhaps there's some room for improvement, but it seems to me that the trade-off isn't sufficient to bear the costs of doing that, given the user indifference to the test already. I've listened to the conversation about headroom, and it seems to me that all flavours of headroom involve further costs. And I am concerned about this issue of measuring internally generated goodwill on an ongoing basis. As we say, we don't have that on the balance sheet at the moment, as Gary said. We start to have almost a shadow set of accounts behind us for this purpose. And I think the cost could be quite significant, actually, and certainly complex. And it's also complex from a user perspective as well. It's not just the preparers. Users will need to understand this. So I would go back to thinking that there are better things we can do around disclosures around the actual deal, perhaps tracking the goodwill that's been built up over time. And I'd be more inclined to think about simplification rather than further complexity.
Okay, Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hess. Two comments. One comment with regard to the single method for measurement of the recoverable amount. The staff views seem that the fair value and the value in use normally will be the same. And the paragraph 31 said that this the biggest single difference cost that maybe value in use will be lower than fair value. And it seems to me the intention staff is try to use single method, which is the fair value. But I agree with Mary's point that in some cases, actually, value in use can provide more useful information for users. I would like to just give a very simple example. If there is a taxi company, and the main assets of this taxi company is the cars, and suppose there is a car, it has been operated, has been running for a couple of years, but it's still in a very good condition. That means the car still can be, running on the road to make money. Suppose it can also can be used next 2 years. And every year, every day, it can make money £200. So first year, maybe around £7,000, and the next year, maybe £7,000. If we discount that, it's around maybe it can make the value can be earned maybe about 40. Maybe we disregard the discount rate. Maybe 14,000. But at current at this day, maybe if we sell, rather if we go to use fair value. That means if we sell this car to the market, to the second-hand market of car, it's very cheap. As I know that maybe only it deserves £5,000. So in this case, the value in use and the fair value will have a very big difference between two. So, and from my point of view, because the car will be used by the company, actually, the intention of the company will not sell the car. So in this case, value in use much will provide more useful information than so-called fair value. That's, let's say, £5,000. So, and this is a very simple cases. And in practice, there are many PPE, such as nuclear equipment. Normally, they will not sell to the market. They will be used for a lot of years. So in this case, value in use much more useful for then for that fair value. So my point that we should be careful to do analysis which method we are going to use, and and what the basic concept that just Mary said that behind or underlying the IS 36, maybe it's different with the US GAAP, I think. Yeah. So this is the first point I would like to make. Second is with regard to the headroom approach or even update headroom approach. I appreciate that the staff are trying to address or resolve the issue about the too little, too late. It's a good idea to introduce the headroom approach, but I agree with Sue's point that from preparers, because eventually the preparers will do this headroom approach. So whether how much cost or complexity they will bear, and the sub, because eventually they will have to do once again the carrying amount, the recovery amount of those units which goodwill will be allocated to them. It's we are trying to measure the internal generated goodwill in this case. It's maybe difficult, especially if we go to updated headroom approach. So this kind of cost, we should be think about that, whether it's feasible. It's ideal, it's a very good model, but it's really feasible, and what kind of cost will be, and whether eventually it will provide, you know, objective useful information to the users.
I mean, just one clarification. I think in the paper, we haven't really indicated any preference from our side as to whether we want to go with VIU or fair value. So we haven't really picked one over the other. And what we've just analyzed is what happens if you pick one over the other. But I totally understand your point about whether it's to do with compliance or whether it's a point in concept or not. That I just wanted to clarify that.
Françoise.
Well, I'm going to try to be short, and it's easy because I agree with what Daryl has expressed, so I don't need to repeat everything. I would like, and I support that we go into this updated headroom approach. And I think it has the merit of, in the form of an indirect measurement, but it has the merit of tackling the issue that has been identified. And in fact, one of the main arguments of those who would like amortization to be reinstated is that the impairment test leads us to recognize, in fact, internally generated goodwill. That's one of the main arguments for reinstating amortization. And also, the thing that I appreciate is that it is based on some form of current measurement. I appreciate it's not in recognition, but it's some form of current measurement. So I agree with those who are who fear that there's some cost involved. I think we need to investigate the issue very robustly and maybe conclude only when we are sufficient around the room to consider that this case is well demonstrated. But I would certainly give a green light to staff to get that evidence on the costs. In response to what Nick said, I mean, we've heard time and time again users when they were asked about the impairment test. Yes, there were insufficiencies, but they still really sent a very strong message that they didn't want to go to amortization, that even if the impairment test was not totally satisfactory, at least some information was released that was helpful. And we can see with this approach that, in fact, the market would receive information more often. So that trend would change, and eventually the interest in users would grow again, especially if it was accompanied by the improvements around making the estimates more enforceable. So I would like also to support what Mary has said and the questioning around what is the form of consultation we should have, because basically research generally is either to collect evidence, and I think the post-implementation review has done that, or test models that are new, innovative, or competitive models that... And here, I think we are, when we look at what we are contemplating, I think we are really in the scope of improving what exactly what already exists, especially with the call of Mary that also supports for keeping on track of, you know, staying in line, consistent with the existing IS 36 and not being carried away beyond that. So why not refocus this project as being an improvement of the existing standards that respond to evidence collected in post-implementation review and get to the market much more quickly in terms of change and improvement?
Amaro?
Thanks, Hans. Most of what I had noted here to mention was already said, but I would start similar as Gary saying, thanking staff for the papers. The papers very well written, and actually they brought me back to the origins of the project. I was first I was surprised with the proposal for a discussion paper. As Mary indicated, I was expecting us at this stage to be more focused in responding to the feedback we heard in the post-implementation review. And the feedback to my mind was aligned with what Nick mentioned, and improved timeliness of the impairment, simplify requirements, and above all, enhance information to users, or making the information more useful in terms of decision-making process. And of course, there is the expectation gap that we identified between preparers and investors, and the feedback also we received recently from ASAF, or we heard from ASAF, GPF, and CIMAC. So all that content that you brought in the paper, in the papers, made me thinking in the same line as what was expressed by Mary. I think we should really focus on providing the response in terms of simplifying and making the information more useful to users. When it comes to the single method or both methods, I guess I'm not strongly opposed to us choosing one method only, but I think Gary made a very valid point about keeping both methods. My recollection from at least the meetings I participated in and what I heard is that that was not really one of the main problems, the fact that you have to resort to value use when the fair value less cost of disposal is higher. And I think if we decided to one method, Mary's point on value use is to be considered. I think we need to be consistent with the whole of IS 36. So if we decide for one method, this is one point. The second way is if we go for value use at the end of the day, I think we'll need to discuss the consistency with the concept of value use in the new conceptual framework and check if we still want to keep the particular requirement in IS 36 for this compared to conceptual framework. But again, I'm not strongly in one camp or the other. It's valid to eventually keep both. As for the headroom, I think there are complexities. I wouldn't expect this to be a easy exercise, although, as I mentioned before, or other mentions, I'm sympathetic to the thinking, or intellectually I do understand what the staff is trying to achieve, but I really have doubts about this is going to address what we heard, first of all, since we are not thinking about a whole discussion of goodwill impairment and IFRS 3. But I think, as Nick anticipated his feeling, there is cost not only to preparers, but also costs to users in understanding and making this information useful. If the information at the end of the day is very good intellectually, in theory, but it's not used, so apparently there's not much to add to what we have at this point. And finally, I think some mentioned, and Nick mentioned, but I would like to re-stress, you bring a paper on disclosure later on. I think really disclosure is there's things that can be done to disclosure to make this whole set of information related to goodwill and impairment more useful.
Martin.
Thanks. Yeah, on this one model or two models, I agree with what Daryl and Mary have said, so I would recommend that we stay with the two methods. On this updated headroom approach, and I think it would achieve what the staff wants to have, it is an earlier impairment, because what this updated headroom approach is doing, how I see it, it is kind of an I would say evaluation model of the CGU, because what you are doing, you value your value in use or fair value of the CGU, and what you're really doing, you compare it with the value of the previous reporting date. And if that is then has decreased, then you impair, but you don't impair the CGU, you impair the goodwill. So what you are really doing is really you do an evaluation of the CGU. And clearly, that will end up in earlier impairment of goodwill. Yeah. But the question is, do you measure really then if the goodwill is impaired, or do you measure that the CGU is decreased in value compared to the previous reporting date? And I really think, okay, that this is maybe a method to achieve this objective, but it's not a measure to achieve this objective is a goodwill impair, because this decrease in value of the CGU from one reporting date to the next reporting date can have thousands of reasons. It could be because acquisition is not successful, but it could also be that the internal generated goodwill has decreased from one period to the next period. And I think information value to investors, if I then in a CFO role and say I have an impairment of my acquisition, but sorry, it has nothing to do with my acquisition, it's very, very successful, but okay, my internal generally goodwill has decreased from one period to the different period, but that was from the existing business, not from the newly business. So is that really good information value? And clearly it would address what you said, if we want to achieve earlier impairment, clearly is a good method. But is it the right method? I think that is really my question. From cost, I think is an improvement compared to if we would update the pre-acquisition headroom. That is easier to do, because what you're always doing is to calculate the recoverable amount. So it is easy, it's only calculation. So it will not add a lot of cost. But from my perspective, it is not adequate to doing that. Because as I said, it can be a thousand reasons why the value of the CGU has increased and nothing to do with the acquisition, and was the acquisition successful, yes or no, and that is what we want to measure. So what we are doing is that we think, okay, we have identified the weakness of the existing model, because we go to the CGU, but take all this away and say, okay, what we're then ending up is really calculating or doing kind of valuation of the CGU. And if we're doing that, then the next question is, why are we doing that only for CGUs where we have goodwill, not for others? What is the reason for that? Why do we doing that? So what I want to say is, maybe it is a good idea, but I think it will not achieve what we really want to measure. Is the goodwill impaired, yes or no? Because it is overshooting that. Maybe we have the problem is undershooting now, but we really don't do overshooting. And therefore, I don't like the model. Because it is measuring what is not the objective of what we should measure.
I think for CGUs that do not contain goodwill, I think whether we do it or not, because that headroom is anyway unrecognized, So I think it wouldn't really matter whether you get into the calculations of headroom or not. But when the headroom all evaporates and then the assets of the CGU, let's say, are impaired, I think the impairment losses would automatically get captured when an impairment testing is done. But that doesn't really happen when you have an acquired goodwill. And also this question about success of an acquisition, I think things about whether an acquisition was successful or not are probably relevant for the first few years after the acquisition. But once we move away from those first few years, I don't think the acquired goodwill would have anything to do with the acquisition.
Yeah, but look what you are doing then. Let's assume you have really a very successful acquisition. Then the value in use increases from 1 year to the next year to the next year. But then in the third year, there is not such a big increase, but still not impaired. So it is a kind of slightly decrease. Because the reason you compare it to the value in use from the previous year, not to the origin, you say it is impaired. But overall, looking at the overall 3 years, it is a very successful acquisition. It has only changed a slightly little bit from the previous year to the current year when you measure it. And then you determine the goodwill is impaired and the whole acquisition is shit. And that is why I think the method is not adequate, because you're mixing up different things here. And it is not that we, all the goodwill is not that we, let me say, okay, what we, for me an impairment test is okay compared to the cost amount. But what you're doing here is you look at every updating your CGU amount to the current valuation, and then compare it to the previous current value from the previous year. And if that is lower, then you conclude it's an impairment of this original historical goodwill. And that is, for me, conceptually not right. Because it could have then 1,000 different reasons. And that is why I don't like it. When you really would achieve an earlier impairment, I totally agree to that. But is that really then okay, an objective measure of the goodwill? I don't think so.
Tom.
Yeah, so I apologize. I'm going to go back a little bit. First off, I think one of my points was I think people bring a lot of baggage, and I think some of the criticisms are baggage that's brought and could be, dumped. Other criticisms, I think, are more legitimate, and then there are the whole series of pragmatic reasons and also just, could we make it less costly? But I do want to kind of go over what I think are the base elements so that there's less, I think, not relevant baggage in here. I would particularly draw people's attention to everything Martin just said. I think that is the best criticism. It's basically an extension of what Gary said. Gary said, that was an excellent example. What about marketable securities that may have declined? And when you do the calculation, suppose you had a big drop in your holdings, whatever, rates jumped, whatever way, rates moved and they declined. So you get it from that, and as Martin said, more generally, how do you know what's driving it? And so you're basically hitting goodwill with everything. And I think that's, in my view, the most telling. And I just wanted to sort of highlight that. But I do want to come back, though, to compare it with what we've got a little bit and dispense with a couple of things. So, and this goes to cost and measurement and all these things. Currently, as I understand it, you have to do a goodwill impairment test annually, which means you have to measure the value and use of every CGU with allocated goodwill annually. However subjective, however difficult, you got to do it. And then you take that and you compare it to the carrying value. I'm going to put that in an equation. So you say, value. I'm going to use value and use, not recoverable, just because I'm more comfortable. So. Value in use minus carrying value, if it's greater than zero, no impairment. And in fact, I think the staff were really good to point out that if you're way, way above, you probably don't even have to generate a point estimate. You might just say, my range is so high, and it saves a couple of bucks probably. But if you're getting closer to zero, or you might go negative, you go value in use minus carrying value is less than zero, and then you take that answer, whatever amount less than zero, and you impair the goodwill by that. So that's what we're doing today. That's what we have to estimate today. And for a couple of things, when we do the value in use, the criticism I think Gary and Martin make is, when we do it now, we don't worry about what happened to the marketable securities. We assume that the whole of the thing falls on goodwill under the current status, I believe. So that the current thing carries that criticism. We don't see it as much for something I'll come to in a minute. So then what does the proposal do? It takes the same mathematical information exactly, and it puts it in two steps. And remember, we do it annually now. So in the first year, and it's always there's sort of two things going on in each year, but in the first year, you take value in use minus carrying value equals headroom. You then store that. Then in this next year, you go for your test, instead of value in use minus carrying value is more or less than zero, you go value in use minus stored estimate of headroom. You know, conceptually, headroom is a concept. So value in use minus headroom minus carrying value, and if it's greater than zero, no problem. If it's less than zero, same thing. You take the difference and you write down the goodwill, and you don't care in the current, you know. So when they do that, I agree, the marketable securities could still have moved, but we weren't doing it before, and we're not proposing to do it now. But because if you do headroom, the point I'm going to come to is it probably didn't matter before because we were so many light years away from having an impairment. So the first thing is, and I want to come back, notice there's nothing in there that says you have to estimate internally generated goodwill. The only thing you have to estimate is value in use. We do that now. And it's just two steps. And so you store it from one, and you don't do it more often. You do it every year and you store it. So where people said, I don't see that as being, it's exactly the same math. You just add one step, you store something for a year. I don't see that as a huge jump in complexity. And what it's going to do if you do it, and I think, again, I really draw people's attention to Martin's criticism because I think it's the really key one, is it is certainly going to result in more impairments. And it's definitely going to do something about the too little, too late problem. I would argue, and again, if I do it as a concept, and I won't do it here, but I could make this argument, if you put in the ideal headroom, you would actually probably get goodwill precisely, and you would miss Martin's problem. If somehow you could kind of get from somewhere in the heavens, they tell you exactly what headroom to shove in, then you would actually not have the problem Martin cited. But we can't do that. So I think it would be more representationally faithful. I think it would be more relevant. I note that the staff said even our highly biased measure has some relevance to the market tests. I think a more timely one would have more, but that's an empirical matter. So I want to then pick up, that was one big point, is all you need to do is estimate and measure the same stuff we're measuring now. The second point I want to make about this is, and again the staff picked up something, is just how good or bad is what we're doing now? How representationally faithful is it? And they said that I think the S&P 500 is 2 or higher market to book ratio. Europe is 1.7, say. And when you do the test, if you think about the value and use, if they're really measured adequately and you summed up all the segments and put in something for corporate, they should probably add up more or less to the market value. It's kind of like a sum of the parts valuation. So you do that. So if I use those numbers and just say the average segment in the United States probably has as much headroom as it does assets, net assets, less liabilities, the average entity in Europe probably has a segment, has about 70% of headroom relative to its assets. So before you do an impairment, on average, you got to chew through 100% of the value of the assets or 70% of the value of the assets in Europe. That's a lot of chewing through. And if we're going to argue that what we have now is representationally faithful, I would say, no, it's a pretty biased measure. And in fact, if you sort of think of that headroom measure, where you go value in use minus headroom minus carrying value, what the status quo does is it substitutes the value zero for headroom, the lowest number we could possibly put in there. So we have a biased number. Now, I'm not saying we should go, because I think Martin makes a good, really good point, and there's other stuff. But it ought to rise and fall on its merits. And I think if we do decide not to proceed, because I don't think this, it would be radical, it would actually write down a lot faster. I think it would go to meet some of the concerns of the people who like amortization, who really don't like this quite biased number on the balance sheet, I think, which is why we keep getting the EPRAG proposals and so on. But I think we should kind of do it on its merits. So I think the complexity that it generates, fine, but I don't think we should exaggerate that. I think we should be really conscious of preparers. And again, if you do this, by the way, one thing, if you just leave the status quo, you could go to indicators and save them a lot of money. This clearly you've got to do it every year so you don't get to do indicators. So that's a cost you're imposing that we might be able to remove. So I just wanted to kind of set, because when I started this, I thought this was kind of a dumb idea, but the more I looked at it, the more I think it's actually would capture the economic or faithfully represent what's happening in the economy as much as we possibly could. We don't know how much users would react, but the fact that the status quo, which is horribly biased, isn't used much, I don't think it still produces something. I don't think we can conclude that they wouldn't react to this if we produced a new number and explained it. So I think, and I just want to commend the staff as well, because I think they've actually made a really great attempt to stick with the principles of, is it representationally faithful, is it relevant, and is it addressing something that a lot of people have raised. I'm not saying we should go there, because I am cognizant of the original scope of the PIR and then the comments Martin made, which I think were excellent, which I think are extension of what Gary made. So anyway, that was just, I wanted to put that context in, is that I think we should try and stick to what are the really key problems and advantages of it.
So, but it does not lead you to the conclusion that we should pursue this?
I wanted to do a more neutral statement of what I thought the critical factors that should be our decision criteria and pull myself out as what would be my preference. But I do want us to be kind of evidence-based and have, a really clear understanding of what we're rejecting or what we're going to do. Yeah. I would actually think that, in answer to your question, I think it would probably be worthwhile to explore a little bit more and do some kinds of simulations and stuff like that. And I think be sensitive to what Martin said. And I'll again remind everybody that in the current test, we don't acknowledge what Martin said. So we're going to put a new test here. But I think there's a reason we're going to put a new test here, is what Martin said is you will actually be writing down a lot. It is going to do a lot for the too little, too late, and then we're going to get a lot of pushback if people say, but you're writing down unfairly. Mm-hmm. I think Martin made I really want to stress, I think that's a super excellent point that we need to consider. And again, it's an extension of what I think Gary said. So I think we ought to do a bit of exploration about this, and I think we need to stress test it a little bit where we explain exactly what the information is, because I've heard so many people make statements that I think are not consistent with what's being proposed. I'll make one last comment that's also important. Just the headroom can be, in my view, put in three lumps, and I really think we should be using precise language and not call it internally generated goodwill. Headroom is changes in value of recognized assets. So if you were in a highly inflationary economy, you could get a whole pile of stuff from that. Two, unrecognized identifiable assets that are missing. Three, non-identifiable, non-recognized assets. That's the internally generated goodwill. So it's one element of the things that make up headroom. And again, I think if we're going forward, we should be very precise in our language. And if we're going to encourage people to do stress tests and explain, then I think we need to use really precise language and understand what we might propose. But it would go a long way, and it would be interesting, for example, to hear the proponents of amortization, who I think don't like the biased number, what their reaction would be to what would be a less biased number. So, but I'm actually not sure, because I think there's some compelling arguments to just stick to the narrow PIR. I think Martin makes excellent comments, so I'm not sold on what our final solution would be.
Doc?
Thank you. I just want to respond what Nick said a few minutes ago. I know that lots of users are not very much interested in impairment. This is because they knew some of the goodwill has already impaired, or some user says they already minus the amount of goodwill from the net worth, so they don't care. But that exactly means we need to address in the financial statement, because our financial statement is not believed, is not used by users. They don't believe our financial statement, but they estimate by themselves. So if that is the case, we need to address. That is one point. And the second point is the impact of having overstatement, because it could change the behavior of the issuers, preparers. Actually, in US market, as Tom pointed out, there are a large number of goodwill, and it contains lots of headrooms. And those who has a huge number of market cap can easily make a very aggressive acquisition, and the very aggressive acquisition could increase their performance quite easily. So that causes a very pro-cyclical movement. And actually, some of the smart investor knows these companies too aggressive, so therefore we write off by themselves and do not investment. But not all the investors are such sophisticated. So as long as they have high performance and the high value of asset, then they may invest. It could cause very pro-cyclical impact. So we need to address it. And I do share the margin concern. We may be overkilling because we simply require impairment on goodwill in the first place. However, a goodwill itself is something like residual. We don't know what the goodwill is all about. It could be impairment in the first place. So therefore, as long as we impair, we recognize impairment to goodwill in the first place, this is not really overkilling. All we want to achieve is we do not allow overstatement, which is more than the recoverable amount. Thank you.
Nick? Thank you. Just to make it clear, when I go around and meet investors and engage with them and ask them what can we do generally to improve our standards and the way we work, no one mentions this. I have to raise this as a topic myself to say, and are you concerned about impairment testing? You know, we're looking at this. No one is putting this on the table as an issue that is high in their list of concerns. And the second thing, really just responding to TAC, I meet very few investors who are looking to the balance sheet or for us or for standards debtors to value the company. They're looking to the stream of cash flows. They understand there may be a mix of valuations on the balance sheet, but they're not looking to the balance sheet per se, to the value of the company, or asking us to do that in any way whatsoever.
Can I ask you a follow-up question, Nick? Mm. Is anybody saying to you that they think our impairment is not good information because of timeliness? Or they're still interested in impairment from an accounting perspective?
There is still some information value in impairment, and it's more around management being willing to convey to the market that they have made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But by and large, the market has got there, and often it gets there on day one of the transaction. Mm-hmm. But there is a message, actually, where now the slate's been wiped clean, we can now perhaps put some restructuring measures in place, and so on. So there is still...
confirmatory value.
Yes.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. I agree with Tom's very systematic explanation on this model and the weaknesses and the strengths of this updated headroom approach. This model is not perfect, as Martin said. There are some strong weaknesses, but I think it deserves some exploring this model more and more, because the current existing model is the worst model we can have as a kind of a headroom approach, because we are assuming kind of a headroom is maybe zero, or there is a big buffering effect the current existing model has. So anyway, so I agree with the Tom's point. Another thing is a value in use. Darrell and Tuck said that this is kind of, in part, the issue of compliance. But that is one reason. However, I don't think that's the main cause of the popular use of value in use, and to lead to late problem, because you know the value in use, we made a kind of a flexibility to be given to prepare its watch. So it looks like a value in use is a kind of a level 4 in the hierarchy. Based on our PIR of the IFRS 13, many investors would like to have information on whether this hierarchy is level 2 or level 3, because investors might have a different weights on this information on level 2 and level 3. So the investors do not like level 3 information of fair value. So in this case, value in use, we are allowing preparers to estimate anything, because not anything, but based on their decent budget and forecast, using all kinds of information. So I don't think they are violating our standard when they calculate the value in use. So they are doing their best. As Martin said, based on his experience as preparers, the preparers are just are using their optimistic business plan of the future. They are doing their best, so they are doing right. So they don't violate anything of their our requirements. So what I'm saying is level 3, in the case of level 3 fair value, it's not respected much in the market. So that's what I'm saying. Level 4 is much worse than the level 3 in markets. That's what I'm saying. We need to improve this level 4 into at least level 3, even though that is not a fair value in a model and the specific model. However, as Mary said, there is a kind of conceptual issue with the difference between the U.S. FASBs. However, that's another part that we have to think about. However, markets would like to have at least a fair value level 3 approach, level 3 model information. So I think this is another, maybe mainly not the issue of compliance. That maybe our standard is too flexible. And our previous chair of the David Tweedy is working with the International Valuation Standard Commission Council to make this kind of a measurement is to be comparable among all companies in the world. So if you allow them the level 4 or kind of value in use measurement, we might, based on such information, if we decide some kind of an impairment loss, then such kind of information might not be comparable among many companies. So that's why I'm saying we need to make a more high quality standard, and that will produce high quality information. Another thing is that update the hedger approach. Before saying anything on that, is there any additional cost if we use this kind of updated hedger approach?
There could be some situations in which there will be some additional costs. Mm-hmm. But
for example, what cost?
If there's a restructuring, then there might be a need to calculate value in use, just before the restructuring happens or just after the restructuring happens. But then it wouldn't be a significant cost, because an entity would have been doing an annual impairment test and doing the calculation. So there would have been some calculation available at the previous testing date. So some roll forwards can be done. So we're not saying that there's absolutely no costs. There would be some costs in some situations. And as also Tom was saying, it's not always a perfect point measure. So if it's always if it's only a range that the company has determined, there would be some costs in perfecting the calculations to come up with a single point estimate.
Yeah, it seems to me that the cost of this updated hedger approach is somewhat not delivered to board members. The cost of this model seems to me not so big enough to say you know, maybe this is too difficult, too complex, yeah. too costly. It seems to me you designed a kind of a less, very cheap model to, you know, cure the weakness of the current existing model. Not much, because of cost constraint. You suggested a very simple model using the information available now. So, you know, that's almost that costly at all. So because of your constraint, cost constraint, you couldn't develop a more fancy model. That's maybe your consideration of the benefits and costs both. So what I'm saying is the current model is, as Tom summarized, we have to think of this model as a two component. One is at the acquisition date, you have to calculate the pre-acquisition headroom correctly. After that, we are computing the subsequent change of recoverable amounts and just recoverable amounts, because carrying amounts are always calculated by the current and previous year. So we are focusing on the changes of these two changes of recoverable amounts and carrying amounts, because we are assuming we calculate the pre-acquisition headroom correctly. So in combining these two steps, this model can be more robust and can provide more benefits. But still, there is some weakness, as Martin pointed out. There is some kind of change in purchase goodwill. That value is included in the one of these two recoverable amounts. So what I'm saying, there is still some weaknesses. However, based on some kind of your analysis, this is quite a reasonable model. This model is much effective than the current existing model, because you don't have to pay many additional costs. So it is worth exploring this more.
Okay, let's quickly try to round this off.
So just a couple of bits and pieces then. I think Nick's views on users are very important, but I think it comes into the question that Sue asked, is that I think sometimes financial numbers have predictive value, sometimes they have confirmatory value. It's one way of thinking about the impairment is as a confirmatory value thing. I agree with the way Tom's description of the way the model would work in terms of new information required is what I was thinking about. Tom, you mentioned the idea of pulling numbers from somewhere above to get a solution, and I think that number, what we're talking about there, is the idea of being able to split goodwill up into its various components, the various elements that drive this calculation. Now, I think we've agreed both in the past and going forward that we're not going to require that. And as long as we don't require that, we have an imperfect solution, whichever way we look at it. So we're not discussing two perfect solutions, we're discussing two imperfect solutions. So coming to Martin's point, I think, about the fact that the information now that I'm going to be getting is going to result in more impairments, I think that the decision that we then weigh up is, in the existing environment, when things start to happen that are negative, I know nothing, I see nothing, I don't hear anything until such point that I've reached a point where I finally run out of anything at all. Under an existing model, and a new model that would go down this route, I would get too much information, and there would be a requirement for management to explain on an ongoing basis what has driven the deduction, what has driven that impairment in this particular period. And Martin's absolutely correct. Sometimes it'll be a poor acquisition, and sometimes there'll be other reasons. But I think the question for us to answer is whether having more information about it that needs to be explained versus no information at all and not knowing it's happening, what is the better model? And I think I'm sort of giving you a view here on what I think. The other point, though, that I think does come into this is a little bit of a discussion on asymmetry. Because the one further concern that I would have down the approach we're going here is that if an event happens that leads to an impairment of goodwill, I take the knock. If the next period that event reverses itself, we don't build up the goodwill again. That's something we're just going to have to be able to talk to why we think that's the case and why we think that's an acceptable answer. Was that everything I wanted to touch? Yes. One other thing was just on Nick's point, and I agree that this is not necessarily front of mind for users in terms of the things they'd like to see us change. But certainly the other thing that I have not heard from users is the idea that they would like to see a reintroduction of amortization. So I think that's equally in that same place, that we just need to bear that in mind.
So we're dealing here with a post-implementation review. And I think a post-implementation review should only in very rare cases lead to a discussion paper. Mm. Namely, when our constituents tell us what you have now is not working at all, and you need to go in a completely different direction, we are not sure, and then with the board could create something new, and then you would have to go through a discussion paper.
And I think that's valid.
I don't think we are there. I mean, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the current model, but it's very varied, and people also don't really know. They all acknowledge there is no easy answer, and I don't think they want us to waste a lot of time trying to find the perfect answer where everybody knows it's not there. You know, if we're going to do things like introducing, if we're going to improve the current model, it has to be of modest proportions, and it has to be easily explicable to our constituents. And when I hear the skepsis around the table about the headroom approach, I have very severe doubt that it would get anywhere. To tell you the truth, the other issue I think has also met considerable skepsis. So this discussion doesn't lead me to feeling that I'm not sure if it's we should ask the staff to put a lot more energy in this, but.
Quickly, and this is just a comment on cost, and Chung Wu triggered my thought on it, but he wasn't the first one that said it today, is I actually agree with you in a narrow vacuum. The updated hidden approach is perhaps in of itself not all that expensive or incremental cost, because it presumes you have to do this once annually. Let me tell you, doing it once annually in a big company is a lot of work. In my former life, at least 3 months of dedicated staff time I'm doing it. So any companies, large portions of goodwill and matrix-styled operations and stuff. So saying that the step two you're introducing isn't a lot of work, but it presupposes a step that already exists that is a lot of work, and which is that step is where the disagreements, coming through in the PIR, the problems about cost and complexity. I'll just leave it at that. But just don't assume you already got something that's just there, because it's not there. It's a lot of work to get it. And you still got, repeat my earlier comment, if you have acquisitions throughout the year, do you have to routinely update it? To draw an analogy to IAS 19, every time you have an amendment or a curtailment, you will update your actual assumptions and your actual valuations. Would this be philosophically any different than you got defined event that you update?
I support that this is an ED, and I think it's got several elements. I think we're trying to respond to what the PIR told us, and I would support going with several aspects, and that would include the updated headroom. Obviously, there's varied views just around the table. I think that the preparers won't like it. But let's see if anyone else in our stakeholder group is supportive of it. Because we're talking about users. We know that enforcers and auditors were vocal in the PIR process. What about these proponents of amortization? Would it in some way fit with them? If we put it in and we get totally negative feedback, then we would remove it, but at least we would know. If we don't put it in, we won't know if there's anyone in support. And Tom was very articulate about the reasons why this could improve accounting, which is our business. So, in summary, I think that the PIR has several elements. We're trying to respond. The updated headroom approach is a part of that. I don't see it outside, as Tom perhaps sees it outside AS 36. I don't. I think it's within. I think it's part of the response to the PIR. It is limited, as we've said, by the recoverable amount calculation, and if there's anything we can do to improve the way that works for people and auditors and enforcers, we would endeavour to build that into our ED. We've talked about disclosure and we will talk on that more, and that's a key part. But I think it's all about responding to the PIR within the context of IAS 36. It has to all sit within our concepts and our current practices. So that's my position.
Françoise?
Well, what I wanted to say is that I feel that Martin's criticism is really the criticism you could express to the impairment model of goodwill already today, because basically you rely on indirect measurement. So that, I mean, it may be wrong to impair goodwill of a good acquisition, but, I mean, it's equally wrong and eventually worse and not to impair goodwill of a bad acquisition just because it would be protected by internally generated goodwill. So I think the updated headroom is heading into the right direction in strengthening a model that indeed has the weakness of relying on indirect measurement. The other thing I wanted to say, because AI statistics, if I'm not mistaken, requires that goodwill is located to the smallest cash-generating unit. So normally you would not expect to have different businesses in a cash-generating unit at which goodwill is located that respond differently to economic drivers. So maybe that is also something that should be strengthened if you want to avoid the fact that a good acquisition be dumped because of the cash generating unit in which it has been incorporated doing badly. Analysis of economic drivers would be needed. And finally, because I see also the clock running, I mean, we have the simplifications in paper 18C, so I didn't want to raise these issues, but I've read these papers very much in conjunction, so to me, I read this paper and my support is linked to having a VIU that is based on management expectations as they are built in the entity and not a set of data which is solely for the purpose of the impairment test, so that when they include the scenarios of enhancement and investment that you propose as simplifications, I think it's also why of strengthening the quality of data, making it a condition that these are really used as part of the internal management system.
Can I maybe just comment on Martin's concern, which I think is a very valid concern, but I wanted to link it a bit to what Françoise just said as well about identifying the level at which goodwill is. So the existing test at the moment says that if there's a decline in the headroom, it's all allocated to headroom, or if it's a declining recovery amount, it's all allocated to the headroom. And what the updated headroom approach says is it's always allocated first to the acquired goodwill. Now, I think you could envisage a middle ground maybe that says the default is it's allocated to the acquired goodwill, but if you can show sufficient evidence that there's some other factor that's driving it, then maybe you could allocate it there. And then I think we could maybe exploit the things that Tom was talking about, which is that most of the data for this test we think is already being calculated anyway. And so if management's giving that justification, there's actually the information available to give the disclosure about what that headroom was, and you can make them disclose what the factors were that they identified that made them override the default. And so you might actually end up quite a kind of useful self-reinforcing package then of how that works together. Particularly reinforces the idea that the goodwill is supposed to be pushed down to the lowest level you can. And so if you have an identifiable factor, it needs to be a really identifiable factor, I think, if it's going to be consistent with that perception.
So we're going to have a very, very good articulation of what all the information benefits are.
Mm. So the papers don't ask the questions to the board, but, I mean, but first of all, I would say if we're going to put something in ED, I think we must have the feeling that there is a reasonable chance that it will fly, mm-hmm. not just to test an idea. So I think that if we ask this staff to pursue these ideas, well, I think we need to test in the board now. whether we want to ask the staff to pursue these two ideas perhaps separately. And I think everybody should answer that question with the question in the back of his mind: do we think that if we pursue this, that it stands a reasonable chance? Apart from the question, do I agree with it or not? Mary?
One thought about the decision we're going to have to make later, not today, about ED versus DP. The one kind of piece that seems to be the thing sticking up and pushing for DP is this new idea of headroom. You know, and I'm not talking about updated versus stable. From my perspective, the big question for me is cost. And I'd hate for us to be driven to a different kind of consultation document because we're trying to get cost information. How hard is this to do? You know, what about only one piece of it when we feel everything else is set? So, Hans, to answer the question you were just teeing up, I feel like for everything else, I can have at least a preliminary decision. But for that one in particular, the cost, how hard is it really to do? I kind of want different information. So it says to me either peel that off or pause, go get information, see if we can get anybody to do kind of simplified field tests or something like that. Because if the staff comes back and says we were naive and it's a lot harder, especially if you get, you know, a larger company that has number of acquisitions and restructurings, or comes back and says, you know, the initial feedback is that, as the staff thought, it's incremental but only slightly to our current requirements for annual calculation. That has a big impact for me in terms of weighing cost benefit with what we, you know, go ahead with. So, but it's only that piece. The others, I feel, we can make decisions about.
For me, it's not only that piece, I have to say, because I think that even if we can convince ourselves that it's not a large amount of cost, it's not going to be nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to have a good understanding of whether investors and users of financial statements actually think there's going to be better information content, given the shortcomings which Martin has raised, which I think were very good points. And I completely understand the argument that it's sort of flipping on its head the problem we've got today. Mm-hmm. So now everything's being masked by mm-hmm. all of the other components of the valuation, and we're flipping it on its head. But we're sort of changing one set of imperfect information for another, yeah, and asking people to suffer some costs.
Let's not restart the whole discussion. Let me just simply ask staff and the board and take any consideration do we wish the staff to pursue this idea of the headroom approach further at this point?
The updated headroom?
Yeah, the updated headroom approach. Mm-hmm.
So that's not enough. Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Is amortization totally off the table as well?
No.
Okay, because they'll bring up, wouldn't mind having somebody explain why they think amortization makes more sense than this. Yeah. If we're going to keep staff kind of on tasks, but
yeah. I mean, there is one thought we can go into this: is are we getting closer and closer? It feels like we might be getting closer and closer to disclosure only changes to this, and in that case, something around the headroom space might actually make sense from a disclosure perspective. Familiarize people with the process. They are, as we've now mentioned a couple of times around the table, potentially doing this type of calculation already because that's what they're required to do as part of the process. And if that's where we're getting to, then that seems to suggest a quite quick process from here forward. I find it quite difficult to think that anything we do outside of disclosure only is going to end up in an ED. I think it starts to push us quite quickly towards a DP as soon as we start exploring new ideas here.
So what is it exactly that you're proposing?
So I'm saying, is there any support perhaps around the table for a disclosure-only solution at this point for what we're talking about?
That's next. What
about the simplifications?
What about simplifications?
Well, the thing is, a lot of the simplifications then answer the preparer's concerns and ignore the user's concerns.
Well, we hear from the user that there are no concerns. I see three. Yeah, François?
The cost, I think, if we look at the cost of the updated headroom, we have to take it into account. We have to take into account the savings from the simplifications as well. So that I would agree that you have supplementary cost and that could be rejected with the definition of VIU as it is. But we have to take into account that if we bring the simplification of the VIU, we're going to in fact respond to the issue of the cost of the impairment model altogether, so that the increment to cost of the updated headroom may be less than what would have been saved in the first place. So I think it should be seen in combination.
Mary?
About the headroom, specifically the updated headroom, I don't want to pursue it as part of a let's keep focused, respond to the PIR, respond. I think it's good thinking, interesting thinking. I actually would like to have it developed, but I kind of want to take it out of this. And let's clear away the other stuff and decide if we are doing something, et cetera. I think, and I think having that at a different stage in development, different levels of information, is complicating us trying to close off, you know, a lot of the rest of the response to the PIR. I think, as Tom and others have suggested, it may actually be an alternative approach on the perpetual debate about amortization or not of goodwill. Mm-hmm. And I'd almost like to take that question, you know, do we reconsider or not, and pre-acquisition headroom, package them together and say, put them off, now let's address all the other stuff, see if it's simplification and disclosure. We haven't, I think, seen anything else that we want to pursue about effectiveness, and try and get that package together and figure out what's the targeted package. So, to your question, do I want to pursue pre-acquisition headroom? I did not put up my hand because I don't want it to bog down clearing off the response to the PIR, except that it may be a counterbalance to,
What are you proposing?
I'm saying take the consideration of do we reopen amortization of goodwill, which is not in this month's papers, package it with further research on this pre-acquisition headroom, separate it, let's take all the rest of this stuff.
Put it in our research agenda again.
Yeah. Take the rest of this stuff and let's finish the response and simplification.
We have to address all these questions at the PIR, guys. We cannot just keep things on the table forever. Doug,
yes,
we voted.
But Tom raised a good question, I think.
Yeah, actually,
what was his question?
Although we voted,
the amortization's back on the table.
Yeah, we voted.
Taken off.
Well, we'll see it when we discuss it. We haven't discussed it yet.
Yeah. Although we voted that only six people supported this idea, we should respect it. But this is the first time we discussed this approach. And actually, as Tom explained, conceptually, we are trying to address the whole headroom. In the first time, it was first time to address there is a whole headroom, which is different from pre-acquisition headroom. We have a huge headroom that makes the impairment test delaying. So it's in a sense, it's a bit too early to rule out this idea completely. Of course, if we decide to go this idea, we need to have more time. And we would like to come up to the response to PIR. That is what we have to do now. However, we came up with finally the really very important core problem of this goodwill issue. So just forget about everything. It's a bit too early. Of course, I respect this decision. However, conceptually, I would like staff to
consider the conceptual background of this approach. And with respect to the Tom's question about reintroduction of amortization, I think you know, it's a big question. However, there might be some opportunity that we can use amortization as a practical expedient, like we have a premium allocation approach in the insurance project. So if we have a fairly good concept of addressing the headroom, and then we have to address this huge headroom, then we could have, you know, idealistic method like updated headroom approach. But because of the complexity, or because of the point, because of the problem Martin pointed out, we do not make it as a standard. However, as a practical expedient, which is equivalent to the updated headroom approach, we could introduce something like earlier short-term amortization, like premium allocation approach. Such kind of way would be possible.
Okay, you got it in, Doug?
Yeah.
That's good.
The first thing I said today was that I thought that we needed to give the staff enough feedback today so that they could come back with a sort of package of what they thought the best overall response was to the feedback we got to the PIR. And I think I'm sort of still in that place, because I think...
Well, you know, so perhaps then the question was premature, but I really wanted to get a sense from the board, and you know, is there a lot of support for this?
And I think that the people who didn't put their hands up, and I'm sort of speaking for you, and I may be misspeaking for you, so I'm sure you'll tell me if I am. But for me, I'm not convinced in isolation that the costs are justified for the information benefits. Now, that doesn't mean you can't convince me, but then Tom's question is a good one, because does that mean that therefore I'd want to go to amortization to deal with the timeliness? And the personal answer is no. So I think we need to look as a package, if you take into account what we might do on updated acquisition headroom, the simplifications and the disclosures as a package, what's the best package of responses to the PIR? And maybe so it's premature to say we're definitely not going to do that, the updated acquisition headroom approach now, because we need a better idea of what the overall package is.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, we need to see mm-hmm. all of the pieces together in a sense.
Yeah, I my sense from the discussion was that what you'd like to know about the updated headroom, if we don't sort of throw it off the table totally at this stage, would be you'd like to know a bit more about the costs, not necessarily in huge detail at this stage, but I think you'd like to know more about the things that might drive the cost there. Possibly maybe a bit more about things that might mitigate Martin's concern as well.
Well, that is fine, so you can put some more work in that. What really undermined my confidence in this model is that what Martin said about how easily it is to undermine the conceptual basis under this approach. And no matter what we do, the preparers will hate it, even if it's only perceived cost rather than real cost. That would never stop me if I were convinced it was going to be a huge improvement. But here I'm not so sure.
I think we need to work hard on that balance.
But I agree with Sue. I mean, our problem is always that we look at things very partially, and that we only come to the complete picture at a very late stage. So I'm willing to let it sit for a while and ask for staff to come up with a complete response, and then we can pick it up again. But I think the sense of the board is clear.
But can we at least, maybe not today, but before you bring it back, we should go through the simplification and disclosures and other factors first.
Yeah.
You know, before you.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
That was my question too.
All right. Well, we are a bit over time. I suggest we take a break. Shall we come back at 1 o'clock?
Yeah.
Yeah?